Okay, repeat the question.
Sometimes when we use our rational mind, the answers seem ambiguous. And we hear sometimes to follow our intuition or follow our heart. Could you comment?
Well, I'm very happy that you asked this question. This is a question that is common in the West, because, you see, I don't want to be critical of other people's ideas, but in order to explain this, I have to mention this, that in the West, I told you there was this period called the Age of Enlightenment, when people began to think rationally and they also began to use reason and experimental observation, and science developed. So when that happened, the educated people began to doubt the original dogmas of religion, you see. When that happened, religion had to defend itself. So all the churches began to say, oh, this reasoning is not correct. That is not the way to understand the truth about life. We can know about God by intuition. So I can see God through my intuition. And no one can question that intuition, because it's not rational. It's not a rational concept. So they had the defense that way. And they tried to give attention to emotion, because faith is simply emotion. You believe on emotion. Emotion is blind. So it's a blind belief. So, that kind of argument is really invalid, that there is no such thing as intuition, and there is no such thing as going by emotion. You can go by emotion, but that is not rational, it's not irrational, it's irrational. And so that is not the way to truth. But there are still people who begin to talk about this. And recently, a book came out. Its title was something like Emotional Intelligence. You saw that book?
Yes.
Ah. But if you read that book, you'll find that he's not talking about intuition or anything. He's only talking about emotions and the anatomy and the physiology of the brain and how these things happen. But the title is there simply to attract the people, I suppose, to get people to read it. That doesn't mean that emotion is intelligent. So it's important to understand that. So one important thing that the Buddha brought to the world was that reason is the way. Not that everything can be discovered through reason, that reason alone is the way to truth. That is also not true. Now there are some who say that the Buddha was a rationalist. That is not true. You see, if you read the sutra called the Kalama Sutra, there the Buddha speaks about this. And he points out that even reasoning has to be given up in order to arrive at truth. If you want what truth is, and we can talk about that on some other day, about the Buddhist theory of knowledge or the what is called truth. Buddha's definition of truth. maybe some other time. So anyway, it was a good question. Yeah?
I think that in that question there was another part that really was she was talking about intuition and then to go into your heart.
Yeah.
So I would see that really that as the pratyaksha.
Huh?
When in Buddha's term, actually we call it pratyaksha rather than pratyaksha vashen avbodhikirima.
That is going into the heart.
My interpretation is that I think that is what has been.
Your interpretation may be that, but the problem is the word pratyaksha. Do you know the meaning of the word pratyaksha?
I think so.
What is that?
It's actually there would be understanding which will not change, just like ekanta.
No, that's not the meaning. Pratyaksha, pratyaksha. Aksha means the eye. You see, aksha means the eye. So it is seen through the eye. That is what it is, pratyaksha. That means, what that means is direct experience. That's what it means. What is directly experienced. That is the meaning of pratyaksha. That is, if you want an English word that is being used for that, it is empirical knowledge, empiricism. That is the meaning of pratyaksha. Pratyaksha.
I think it's endorsed the same thing, because I was just thinking the same thing, because when I said not the understanding which will not change, that means it is that really which will be just like concrete, it won't change because you have experienced it.
Yeah, so, but still the Buddha points out that even empiricism is not correct, because here, there the Buddha speaks of thing called ākāra parivitakka. Ākāra parivitakka really means what today scientists call observation and inference. Now you observe something and from the observation you begin to infer, you conclude something, having observed. The observation and inference. That is the meaning of ākāra parivitakka. Ākāra means appearance, how what you observe is the appearance, what appears to you. Parivitakka, vitakka there is the inference. Around the observation you make an inference. Now that is the scientific method. The scientific method is observation, inference and verification. Those are the three main things. You observe something, then you infer from that observation, you draw a conclusion or a theory you build up or a hypothesis, and then you verify the hypothesis through an experiment. That's the verification. So, but that also, the problem with this, now I have to get into this theory of knowledge to explain this, that first philosophy started when people started reasoning and they wanted to get at the truth through reasoning, and that was called rationalism. But what happened was different philosophers using the same kind of logic came out with different theories. So ultimately, they thought reasoning is not the way to truth. And they wanted certainty. They were going after what is called certainty, to be able to accept something without doubt. So always, when a new theory comes up, doubt is brought out. And so, what the philosophers thought was, reasoning is not the way to truth. And then they started saying, the only way to truth is direct experience through the senses. Sensory experience. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. That is So that is called empiricism, empirical observation, empirical verification. So, and that is how science came up. Science is empirical observation, but the problem is, even scientists found that one scientist brings out something like, say, Isaac Newton brought out a thing called gravity. Then after some time, Einstein comes and says there is no such thing as gravity. It is true that an object will fall to the ground if you throw it up, but that is not due to gravity. He used his unified field theory to explain why it happened. And so you see, these even scientists found that the theories keep on changing. And now they are also talking about another thing called quantum physics and quantum theory. And so these are always changing. Scientific views are changing. And so they could arrive at certainty. But the scientist said, we are not interested in certainty. We are satisfied with probability. So any scientific truth is a probability. There is no certainty about it. Till another scientist comes and disproves it, it will be taken as correct. So this is how it goes. So in other words, they saw that that is not the way to arrive at truth. Then another kind of philosopher came up and started saying, well, direct observation through your senses is not the way to truth. Because the truth is, what you see is simply all an image in your mind. So the real truth is beyond that, beyond your sensory experience. And that is, they call that the transcendental truth. And that transcendental truth can be discovered only by mystics with their extrasensory perception. They are going beyond the senses through the extrasensory perception. The mystics can know it. Then, of course, came other philosophers who said, we cannot accept that. Because you are talking about something that you have never seen nor experienced. It's all in your imagination, that transcendental truth. And even if you have an extrasensory perception, that is also another kind of sensory perception. Even if you are seeing it through your mind, if you say, but still the mind becomes another sense organ. You are seeing something. So, they said, the truth, there is no truth to be discovered. We can only talk about truth as a statement. Truth is simply a statement which can be put into words in the form of a sentence. So, truth is a statement which is a sentence. And these sentences can be analyzed to find out whether it is meaningful or whether it is meaningless. So they started giving up the idea of truth and falsehood, and they started using the terms meaningful and meaningless. So a statement can be meaningless or it can be meaningful. And if the statement is about something that is beyond experience, it is meaningless. It is meaningful only if it is within experience. what is not within experience is meaningless. Like if you speak about mermaids, no one has seen mermaids, that is a meaningless statement. And in the same way, if you speak about God and no one has seen this God, again it is a meaningless statement. This is what they start saying. These are the philosophers who are called the linguistic philosophers, like Bertrand Russell and people like that, Wittgenstein, Ayer, people like that. Now, what happened was, when these people said this, there were some other philosophers who started thinking in another way. They said, the purpose of human thinking is not to discover truth. The way to discover, there is no meaning in trying to discover truth. What we can do, the purpose of human thinking is to solve problems. And if a person can bring a solution to a problem, that solution, if it works, it can be tested. And if it works, then it can be called a truth, because it works. So a truth is simply a solution to a problem which works. And they started even saying that if it works, it can be sold, and therefore it has a cash value. So they spoke about the cash value of truth. This is what is called pragmatism. It's a philosophy which was called pragmatism. Then came another kind of philosopher who said, there is only one problem to be solved in the world. All these philosophers are trying to solve useless problems. There is only one problem to be solved, and that problem is the problem of existence, that we, all human beings, are aware that they are existing. Not only that, they are also aware that they are going to die, and that creates anxiety, worries, fears. And therefore, this is the problem to be solved, you see. And there ends Western philosophy. The people who started saying this couldn't solve that problem. And this is where the Buddha enters with the Four Noble Truths. He's talking about a problem which is the problem of existence. The Four Noble Truths, if you study that, you will see that it is about birth, old age, disease and death. That is the problem of existence. And the effort is to solve the problem, how to overcome death. That's the problem. And the Buddha found the way, and that is what we are talking about. So the truth that the Buddha talks about is not a rational truth or a empirical truth or a linguistic truth. It is really a pragmatic truth, an existential truth. This is the important thing to understand. So, even this word pratyaksha has been misinterpreted and misunderstood. It doesn't mean a truth like that. Because there is a sutra called the Chanki Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya. If you read that sutra, there the Buddha speaks about a very important thing about truth. And that truth is really the solution of the problem. So the discovery of the truth is the solution of the problem. And once the problem has been solved, even the Four Noble Truths has to be given up, not to become attached to that as the truth. Because the Buddha uses this as a man crossing the river using the boat. And once the river has been crossed, you throw the boat away, you're not going to carry the boat. But it can be given to others to use it to cross the river. So in the same way, the person who becomes an arahant will make use of the Four Noble Truths to enter that stage, enter Nirvana. And once the person has entered Nirvana, that truth is also given up and given to others for them to come. So this is how it is done. So the Buddha doesn't cling to anything as truth. That's the important thing to understand. That is explained in the Kalama Sutra, where he rejects all these other different possibilities. Yeah, any other questions?
Regarding meditation.
What's that?
Regarding meditation, I have a question.
Yes.
When you have a pain in the leg.
When you have what?
Have a pain.
Pain in the leg?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You concentrate on that, no? And the pain goes away.
It depends on what you call concentration. Concentration, if it is concentration where you try to avoid all other thoughts and focus only on this, that will only create tension and the pain will increase. It won't decrease. But if you can relax to that pain, it will disappear.
You don't think of the pain? You don't think of the pain? You think there is a pain, I have a pain.
No, you can. Think of the pain means you're not thinking pain, 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 pain. That's not the way. But if you become aware of it and relax. The important thing is to relax. The relaxing is the thing that takes the pain away.
How do you relax? When you are under pain, how do you relax?
Well, first you have to learn to relax, and then only you can try that when the pain is there. You can't start relaxing when the pain is there. You see, there was a psychologist in Australia who wrote a book. He wrote a book on forget the title, but he wrote about pain, and he said he went to India to learn how to overcome pain. So he went and studied with the yogis and learned some how to relax. That's what he learned. And then he even went and started sleeping on nail beds. And so he had learned to relax to all these things. And then he wanted to test himself. And he went to get a tooth extracted. He had to get a tooth extracted. So he went to the dentist and said, "Don't give me the anesthetic. I'm going to relax and you can take the tooth off. So the dentist refused. So he thought of another friend of his who was a dentist. And he went to that friend and said, "I am just trying an experiment. You must take out my tooth without the anesthetic." And so I will relax. But first, let me relax, and then after I relax, you do your operation. So he agreed, and then, so he sat and relaxed. And he said, "Now you can start your operation." So the dentist pulled out the tooth and finished, and he asked, "Did you feel any pain?" He said, "No, I didn't feel any pain. I felt the touch of your instruments and all that, but I didn't feel the pain." And then he said, "You know, this was a difficult tooth to extract. I had to go to the bone itself and pull it out, and I had to cut your gums, and I had to suture that, sew it back, and I did all that. You didn't feel any pain." Said, "No. Now that is how you can overcome pain, by relaxing. But first you have to learn to relax. So if you learn to relax properly, it is possible." Now even the Buddha mentions these things in the sutras. These things are possible. Only thing is, today people are so much frightened of pain that they don't like to try these things. But even some of these people who do fire walking and do some wonderful things at Kataragama and all that, with needles and all that, so this is possible under the hypnotic state also. So under the hypnotic state also, you can relax and do that. Any other questions? No more questions, huh? You have a question? Yeah. Don't feel shy.
Well, I'm not a philosopher and I don't...
You don't have to be a philosopher to ask questions.
Well, I can understand about this, the emotions of grasping or desiring permanence and being afraid of fear is not a healthy thing. But there's so many emotions that are so healthy.
What are those emotions?
Well, they seem so genuine and so real and so good. I mean, one is love.
Huh?
One is love. One is discovery. There's some of them that just...
I was expecting that question, but no one asked. At least you asked. That's good. You see, you should read the book written by Eric Fromm. It's called The Art of Loving.
I like that one.
Have you read that?
Yeah.
There you are. Then why you are this question?
I read it when I was 16.
You
years
never
old.
Understood it.
That's a long time.
You never understood it. You see, he spoke of three kinds of love. One he called Eros. The English word love has been used for various things. Eros means sexual love. Love between a man and a woman. That is not the kind of love that what we call the good emotion. No. And then there is another one called philia. He called it philia, means family love. That means the father and the children and that sort of love. That's called philia. And the third kind of love, that is also a self-centered love. That's an emotion. And the third kind of love is what in Buddhism we call metta or maitri. And maybe Christ also spoke of when he said, love thy neighbor as thyself. You know, that is a selfless love. That selfless love is not an emotion. That's the absence of emotions. It's only when all those self-centered emotions are removed that you have the selfless love. And that is not an emotion. There, you can use the word love, but it's more like something like kindness or compassion or something like that, you see, where you are not really attached to anything. Normal love is an attachment. It's an emotion. But the interest in others, for their sake, not for your sake, that interest in others, to help others, that is not an emotion. That's the absence of emotions. But today people call that some kind of good emotion or positive emotion or something like that. But the real selfless interest in the welfare of others is not an emotion. And that is possible only in the absence of emotion. That's what Eric Fromm called agape. He called it agape. That's the third kind of love. If you read that book, you should have understood that.
So in Buddhism, it's compassion.
Huh?
So in Buddhism, compared to Buddhism, it's compassion, not love.
No, no, it's metta, maitri. No, you see, the problem is the English language here. English language, the word love is being used for so many things. That is the biggest mistake. Now, in the Greek or the Latin, they were using different language. Even in Sinhalese, we have three words. We have alaya, prema, and maitri. These are three words there. But in English language, all three are called love. This is the mistake.
But that familial love,
huh?
The familial love you were talking about, like my love for my children and how I would just do absolutely anything for them?
Yeah, you'll do anything for your child, but not to the neighbor's child.
But
why? Why is that? Because you are attached to that child, you are doing that.
So I'm like possessing.
It's an attachment.
The child, yeah.
Yeah. So it's self-centered love. When your child and the neighbor's child are fighting, you'll always take your child's side. Why is that? You see? This is a problem. Mm-hmm. That is the love.
If compassion is there, that wouldn't happen. If compassion is there. That is equal for both parties.
Yeah, compassion, if you have the right compassion, yeah, both parties will be equal. Any other questions? Now you are tired, huh? So okay, we'll bring this to an end.